Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Lots to talk about in today's program. There's tornadoes that struck last night in the south, kind of a surprising time of year for that. Also, gas prices are set to rise. It looks like, anyway. We'll have more details on that and have a list for you of the top baby names in the UK. I think you'll be surprised by some of them. Always interesting to see what the new names are. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm as well. We have a live link at the trumpet.com, and we appreciate you being with us. Myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon here today. I am glad to see you, Grant, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because I like you.
Thank you.
And secondly, because it's cold in here, and that'll warm up extra body.
It is pretty cold in here, actually.
Yeah, it's there's that transitional time of the year where it starts to get cold at night, and if I don't turn, or whoever's here at the end doesn't turn the heat on, it's going to be cold when you come in, so it's a little cold right now.
Yeah, that was a rude awakening this morning when I walked outside. I wasn't expecting it to be as cold as it was.
It is that time of the year. It's getting colder. But, you know, it's surprising because there were some tornadoes, too. I don't usually think of tornadoes this time of the year. Not right in this area, but over in one part of the U.S. This is from Fox News. It says 5 people killed, 3 children injured after possible tornadoes sweep through the deep south. At least 5 people were killed while 3 children at a daycare center were injured after a powerful thunderstorms and possible tornadoes swept through the south overnight. And into Wednesday morning, officials said. Jackson County Chief Deputy Rocky Harnan said early Wednesday that 3 people living in a mobile home in the northeastern community of Rosalie, Alabama, were killed. Another person in the home was critically injured. Emergency officials in Tennessee said 2 more people were killed and at least 9 others injured in severe weather that hit the state overnight. Possible tornadoes were reported across several counties in northern Alabama, southern Tennessee, according to the National Weather Service. So Tennessee has been getting hit with all kinds of things, fire, big-time fire, and now possible tornadoes at the end of November. Kind of strange.
Right, and it sounds like some of those people were in a mobile home. That's probably the last place you want to be during a tornado. Makes me kind of worried. I live in one right now.
For some reason, they always seem to be the targets of it. I don't know why. Maybe they don't get hit more than anyone else. It's just that the structure can't hold up or something. But it does seem like those areas always get hit. So kind of strange this time of the year. I mean, they can happen, but it is a little more rare. They said there's an odd pattern. Weather pattern, and this is another headline related. Odd pattern brings rare November tornadoes to Iowa and Nebraska. Meteorologists say warmer weather has brought unusual November weather to Iowa and Nebraska tornadoes. The National Weather Service statistics show that only 7 tornadoes have hit Nebraska in November since 1950. In Iowa, 41 tornadoes were reported in November between 1980 and 2015. So they can happen. Probably at any time, I guess, if the weather pattern's right. But they're rare. But because of that warmer weather, they're seeing some tornadoes, and I think they maybe saw some yesterday in some of those states. So you don't really expect that towards the end of November, getting into December.
Yeah, usually it happens during the summer months. I don't know how much it has to do with the hot air, but I think that's part of it. And even there in the south, I believe a lot of those places over the last several months are probably about 10 to 15 inches below their regular rainfall levels. So drier weather, warmer weather, and now we're having tornadoes later in the year.
Yeah, and that fire that was going on, I think still going on, or at least it was yesterday in the Smoky Mountain area, but they had like 80-mile-an-hour winds come through there. And so you've got a fire going, and it's dry, like you said, and then all of a sudden you have 80-mile-an-hour winds. That's a very difficult situation that was covered on the news last night on all the national news outlets, and pretty amazing. There's footage that somebody shot from their cell phone or with their cell phone. They were in their car driving through it because they were trapped, and they thought, well, I got to get out of here. And it was crazy. Fire just everywhere. And, of course, you hear them, and they're they're praying out loud because they're pretty scared, and you can understand that.
That is terrifying. I can't even imagine trying to drive through a fire. That's the last thing I would want to do, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then I guess there were a lot of people stuck in that hotel like we were talking about yesterday. It's kind of strange how they all got stuck in there and none of the exits were accessible.
Yeah, I think the fire just came up so quick that all of a sudden, what are you going to do? You're completely surrounded by it. So dry conditions, 80-mile-an-hour winds, and then not too far from there, you're getting tornadoes. So interesting times, interesting days.
Yeah, what did Tennessee do wrong?
What's wrong with Tennessee? What's going on in Tennessee? I never think of Tennessee as like a volatile weather area, but I guess they can have problems like anybody.
I guess.
And the droughts, too. I mean, it's they're ongoing, and sometimes it's easy to forget that certain places are having droughts, but I guess they're having one, or they've had one for a while.
And that's probably the result of these latest disasters. And the drought's the thing we overlook, but we definitely don't miss when there's a big fire or a tornado as a result.
Yeah, and even the tornadoes, they weren't like the top stories today, but that did cause some fatalities there. Here's one that's going to affect everybody probably if you drive a car. That would be most people. This is from Bloomberg. This is kind of breaking news today. OPEC agrees to cut production in drive to end record glut. Of course, they've been pumping oil like crazy, and the market's been oversaturated with it, and the prices have dropped. That has affected the economies in the U.S., particularly in a state like Oklahoma that we're in. It's affected the Dakotas. It's affected Canada because of all the oil production. So this may help in some ways, but also at the same time, prices could go up. They say the OPEC group is to reduce supply by 1.2 million barrels a day. And the benchmark Brent crude prices climbed in London to top $50. So prices are going up. They're, I guess, excited about the fact that they're cutting the supply.
Yeah, and it's right now, at least here in Oklahoma, the prices have consistently been under $2 for quite a while. I would gladly pay $4 a gallon if it meant that the economy of the entire state was stable and you could see that in measurable terms.
There is a big state deficit now because of the drop in the oil prices.
That's so huge here. I mean, that's the sponsor of the Thunder Stadium downtown, and a lot of the biggest buildings downtown are also sponsored or worked in by energy company employees.
Yeah.
So, that's a big part of downtown Oklahoma City.
What's the cheapest you ever remember seeing gas here in the U.S.?
Maybe like 160, something like that. Uh-huh. 140.
I remember a time. I think the cheapest I remember seeing, boy, I don't know. It was under a dollar for sure. It was 89 cents maybe. And I think that was in Oklahoma here back in the 90s. I didn't live here, but I was here for a trip. And I remember driving through and being surprised because it's always a little bit cheaper usually in Oklahoma or places that produce a lot of oil. And it was surprising. It's like, whoa, 89 cents. But it's always funny when a gas station goes out of business and they don't take the sign down, though. And you still see like a really old gas price. And you're like, oh, wow, they went out of business a long time ago.
Sometimes I get my hopes up. I don't notice that the actual gas station right next to the sign is closed.
Yeah.
Hop in there for 50-cent gas, and it actually isn't even open anymore.
That's why they closed. They couldn't make any money. The prices were too low. No, yeah, you see those sometimes. It's a good indication of when they went out of business. It didn't bother to take the sign down. But I always thought, well, I guess, you know, if you see the gas station, you can see an oil well behind it. Maybe that's why it's cheaper. Now, I know it doesn't go directly, but anyway, I always remember seeing some of those, and I thought, well, I guess that would make sense. I know where they're getting it from, right?
I always kind of wondered how they did it anyway. Obviously, they have to have a lot of things underground to make that all work.
Yeah, they've got to pump it out and take it to their refineries and then bring it back and so forth. And then sometimes you see the guy driving the gas truck and he's there and he's filling everything back up. And it's funny, you know, he's driving a vehicle that runs on gas or diesel, you know, whatever. and he's hauling gas for other vehicles. It's just kind of it's a weird system. It's an environmentalist nightmare.
It is.
They should be delivering rainbows to power our cars. Whatever the dream is.
I always find it so funny that people get so upset about the fact that we use gasoline when there clearly has never been anything else that could come close to taking its place.
No, we haven't seen it. And if there is, it's being kept a really good secret by somebody. I'd love to have a solar-powered car that worked. I mean, who wouldn't?
Exactly.
It'd be awesome, but I haven't seen it yet. They say the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries is ditching a pump-at-will policy introduced in 2014 to resume its traditional role as price fixer. The shift, aimed at draining a crude glut that's pushed down prices for 2 years, will help revive the tattered finances of oil-producing countries and reverberate in markets around the world, from the Canadian dollar to Nigerian bonds to U.S. shale equities. So we'll see if that helps the economy here. It'd be nice if it did.
Yeah, it definitely would. It just shows you how something like oil or gas can have an international impact. And it's just black stuff that comes out of the ground, but it's so crucial.
It's interesting, too, because I think I mentioned this before. I'm reading a book on the Dust Bowl time period and this region of the country. And it's kind of interesting because even though certain years during that period of time in the 30s, people really did have low crops. They didn't have a lot of crops come in some cases. But there was also the oil economy going on. And so there was some growth. So they could sell their land sometimes or lease out their land for oil. And that got a lot of people through that time period. So it's always been a big part of the economy here since the 1800s, I guess.
Yeah, we have those oil derricks everywhere that have that kind of swinging pendulum, I guess. It's kind of hard to explain it, but I see them all over. There's just an empty field and a huge oil derrick there.
They used to have those public service commercials. I haven't seen them in a while, but where they would tell you not to play at the old oil sites.
Right.
You know, the kids skateboarding on it, and they say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, I've never had the urge to do that. It just seems like that wouldn't be the best place to hang out. But yeah. I guess that used to be an issue because they had to announce it.
Well, and I mean, some people, I suppose, would buy land, and then it had an old oil site on it that nobody used anymore, but it could be dangerous. It is expensive, from what I understand, to pull all that out and get it fixed up. So I don't have to worry about that. I don't have any. I keep looking for oil in my lawn, but I haven't found any yet. Found a lot of thistles.
You'd probably never come back to this radio station if you found oil in your
yard. Come on. I'd come back. I just have a lot nicer car.
You're too loyal.
Speaking of, I just remembered that I wanted to mention this funny story about my cat. He's a killer. You know, he kills a lot of things.
Right.
And he killed a squirrel the other day, and he left it right out on our welcome mat. He puts everything on our welcome mat.
Of course. So consistent.
He's very consistent. And it was like a peace offering because he'd been in the house, and he got underfoot, and he got stepped on accidentally. And you can always tell because there's that sound that... And so he was underfoot. He knows he shouldn't be in the kitchen area, but he was, and he got stepped on. So we put him outside for a while. And I don't know if he felt bad about that, but we came out about an hour later, and there was a squirrel there in the front for us. And he did a really good job. He took care of business, but he left most of it intact. I guess if I wanted to make a hat or something. And so it's like, okay, nice job. So we pick it up. I pick up the mat, and I go and I just throw it in the bushes. And then the next day, he brings it back, and he puts it back on the welcome mat. I got caught getting rid of his gift, and he's like, wait a second, this is for you.
You must not understand. I was trying to be benevolent here.
I'm giving this to you. So we haven't talked about it, he and I, so I think we're okay still, but I don't know.
Your cat really doesn't have much of a right to get upset about being stepped on. Cats are just so good at doing that. I don't know if you've ever had stairs in your house, but we had, back when I was living with my parents, we had stairs going from the first to the second floor, and a cat would just sprint down the stairs as fast as it could for no reason. As I'm walking down the stairs, I've almost fallen down the stairs a couple times at their house just because the cat likes to get underfoot.
Yeah, they do. And they get crazy sometimes. Like, they'll be normal, and all of a sudden, it'll take off running full speed and, like, climb the wall. And you're like, what are you doing?
Why it'll
you...
make, like, a 20-foot yeah. leap.
Why did you do that?
Stick to landing, though. It will.
And I think sometimes my particular cat, I think he has fun doing some of those things because our garage floor has got like a paint coating on it. It's a little bit slippery if you're not careful. And he'll run as fast as he can across the driveway, and he'll stop and just slide across the floor. I think he's doing it for fun.
Pretty smart cat.
So I don't know. Either he's doing it for fun or he's really stupid. He hasn't figured out that he's going to slide. He goes flying through there. I think he's doing it like a game, you know.
Fun times. Easily entertained.
Easily entertained. That's one of the things about the cats. This is an interesting headline from Breitbart here. We were talking about sports on and off, and I guess the political things that can get into sports. The Nielsen ratings estimate ESPN has lost 555,000 subscribers during last month. That's a lot. They say, in other words, ESPN essentially lost the city of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Not that they're all from there. They're just giving you something to compare it to. Well, as far as I know, maybe Albuquerque said, that's enough. No more sports here.
Maybe they're just gigantic fans of ESPN over there.
No. They say this is coming on the heels of last month, the worst month in ESPN history, where the network lost 621,000 subscribers. So they're losing. I mean, over the last 2 months, they've lost a million subscribers. In the last 2 months, the total has been 1,176,000. A subscriber loss nearly the size of the city of Dallas, Texas. ESPN currently has just over 88 million domestic subscribers. In 2013, a mere 3 years ago, ESPN had 99 million subscribers. That's right, they say, in the last 3 years, ESPN lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million subscribers, the rough equivalent of the combined populations of New York City and Phoenix.
Wow.
Somebody's got to start figuring it out there. They're going to lose some jobs.
So is that talking about like ESPN the magazine subscribers and ESPN Insider online subscribers, people who can read those certain articles that are blocked unless you pay?
No, I think it's talking about just the network.
Wow.
Like, you know, the cable channel. So they've lost that. Now,
is that just like people who are cutting TV altogether? Because I didn't even know you could get ESPN by itself.
Yeah, I don't know. That would probably indicate they're getting rid of cable. They're cutting the cord there. And I'm not exactly sure if they're factoring in, because you can watch some ESPN things online as
yes.
well. So I'm not exactly sure but how they're exactly figuring this. But I think it is mainly the network, their television network. Whether they're consuming it, I don't know how they're consuming it. But, I mean, there is the whole cord cutting that they talk about just in general, where people are getting rid of cable to go to Netflix or to go mm-hmm. to, I don't know, any of the other services out there, watching on demand. But one thing that kept ESPN going was the live sporting events. People really still wanted to see those. But apparently they're still losing a lot of subscribers.
Yes, and they really have done well with putting a lot of at least premier games for football, basketball, baseball, even a lot of like soccer and arena football and lacrosse and other things like that. They have conveniently ignored hockey for a long time, sadly, which I think has upset a lot of people. But yeah, I don't know. It just they still have some good live events, but maybe people just don't really care as much.
Well, the headline's from Breitbart, and their kind of take on it is that it's because they're becoming a little too political.
That's right. And it's hard to avoid it on their website, at least, where they're always trying to support the latest liberal cause.
Right. And some of the shows on there, I don't know. I mean, during the day, you know, in fairness, it is hard to have 24/7 sports programming because you only have so many games. Mm. And then, you know, it's just the same old commentary over and over again. And I really feel like they've gotten rid of or their good talent or their talents left.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of they've been going on this whole idea that, well, we're just too big to fail sort of. And it doesn't matter who's here, who's not. But people leave. And I think it takes a toll after a while.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, now that I think of it, a lot of their sports TV shows during the daytime have a lot of pretty liberal commentary about politics and things like that. There was actually one segment right before the election where the two guys on First Take were talking and saying, you know, it's totally fine that Tom Brady openly endorsed, or I guess privately endorsed, Donald Trump, and it's totally fine that LeBron James would endorse Hillary Clinton. But it was funny the next day, pretty much right after the election, they went back to spewing those lines about how Mr. Trump is a racist and a bigot and a misogynist. And I don't know, they were almost implying like everyone who voted for them is the same thing. So that's not what people tune into ESPN for, yet they keep on talking about those things.
Yeah, I think that has bothered some people. So interesting, they're losing their numbers. So we'll see how it goes. And really, too, even, I mean, one of the draws for ESPN, even without a game, would be SportsCenter, you don't need SportsCenter anymore because you can just go look up any highlight you want to and watch the piecemeal, you know, or just watch the particular highlight without the whole, you know, story that would come from SportsCenter. So interesting to see how that goes. But I'm sure they're counting their pennies over there and saying, okay, now, how are we going to get the ship righted here? But that's hard to do, and technology is changing. That's a factor, too.
It really is. Yeah, one idea would be to silence the political voices. They don't need that on a sports network.
Yeah, I agree. Here's an interesting story from California. Thousands of mysterious jelly-like creatures wash up on Southern California beach. They're these little balls, and they feel like jello. And people that have lived there for many, many years said that they've never seen them before. According to Christopher G. Lowe, he's a marine biology professor at Cal State Long Beach. They say that they think it's sea cucumbers, some sort of weird. I mean, because I looked up pictures of sea cucumbers after I saw the video on the story. They don't look the same, but there's a lot of variety within the sea cucumber family.
Oh, okay.
So they think that's what it is, but they're these weird little jelly balls, and there are like thousands of them on the beach.
Do they have any sort of defense mechanism, or can people just go pick them up, no problem?
Apparently they can pick them up because they were. They were rolling them around and throwing them.
Are they edible?
Well, some people eat them. I don't think that they're maybe should be, but that's a good question because, you know, they were looking at these jelly balls and saying, what are we going to do with these things? Well, as of 2013, there's a thriving black market in sea cucumbers driven by demand in China.
Of course.
Where one pound at its peak might have sold for the equivalent of $300. I go get a big bag of those and sell them. I don't know who you'd sell them. Can you call China?
Just
connect me to China.
Call the government.
Is there a phone number for China? I'm trying to sell these. I just want the black market, though.
Put me straight through to Xi Jinping.
So anyway, they say that they've tried to shut down that market somewhat, so there's some value to those, apparently.
Maybe. What's the reason for shutting down a sea cucumber market?
Well, they say that they were upset because only certain people could afford to eat them, and not everyone could. They were the most expensive and rare species.
Same thing with caviar, isn't it?
I think so. They say in the Caribbean Sea and off the shores of the Yucatan Peninsula, near fishing ports, there's been some conflicts in the communities as rival gangs struggle to control the illegal harvest. The sea cucumber gang.
So many weird things happening in this world right now.
Yeah. They normally dry them up before selling them. So anyway, the video is online if you want to look at it. It's at AOL, and they're just little jelly balls, but they don't look like the sea cucumbers when you look at the pictures, like, you know, online what they normally look like. They usually look kind of like a cucumber, which is why they're called that, and they usually weigh on the seafloor. But these have all washed up on the beach, and they said one of the lifeguards there said there's all kinds of weird stuff happening. He doesn't know if it's like El Nino or what's going on, but he said there's stuff washing up that's kind of strange.
Yeah, the sea creatures are all fleeing the sea, which means maybe there's something bad coming.
I don't know. They said they have a lot of stingrays showing up, and they usually don't get that close to the beach either, but they're showing up too. So anyway, it is funny. All these little things wash up, and people just pick them up and look at them. I don't know that I'd pick them up. I'd probably say, I'd send somebody else to do it. I'll pick up that thing and see what happens. Poke it with a stick first.
Yeah, it could be just like a jellyfish that would electrocute you if you touched it. That would be my first thought if I was out there.
I don't think I'd pick it up. But anyway, they're just little jelly balls. So if you're out there in the California, maybe go get a bag. Sell them to China.
Throwing them at people would be really entertaining, I think.
That's, you know,
seeing like how it would impact.
Yeah.
What it would feel like.
They said it feels just like jello. The poor sea cucumber.
Amazing.
You know, he just wants his normal life at the bottom of the sea, and he's getting chucked around on the beaches in Southern California. UK's top baby names for 2016. There's some interesting ones here. The top one for girls is Olivia. So that's a nice name. Lily comes in next. Sophia, Emily, Amelia, Ava. Hey, that's my daughter's name.
Yes,
that's
it good. Is. Wow. You're on the list.
I'm a trendsetter. Isla, Isabella, Isabella with an E, I guess. Isabel, I don't know. And Sophie. So those are pretty normal names. You hear those in a lot of places. The boys' names are pretty normal with maybe one exception. The number one is Oliver. We'll skip number two. We'll come back to that one. Number three is Noah, then Harry, Jack, Charlie, Jacob, George, Ethan, Henry. Those are all pretty standard. Number two for the boys' names in the UK is Mohammed.
Oh, boy.
That shows a change in demographic, doesn't it?
It really does. That's the clear outlier in that entire list.
Yeah. You're doing the roll call, you know. Oliver, Noah, Harry, Jack, Charlie, and Muhammad.
Wait, what? Is this the right place?
Am I in the right building? So that is interesting. But there is quite a large population of Muslims in the UK. What do they call London? They call it Londonistan. Londonistan,
like Afghanistan or something like that.
Right. So Muhammad is the number two name. I guess that would. I wouldn't imagine that you'd call your child Muhammad if you weren't Muslim. Maybe you would. I don't know.
It would be extremely, extremely rare, at least. But we see over there the struggle for two different cultures to coexist. But at least they have a very popular name on the list.
Number two. So that, I guess, would indicate birth rate, that there's a lot being born. So there's probably a lot to read into that. Interesting. So, of course, this story is happening here. This is from The Week. A New York man steals $1.6 million worth of gold flakes. I didn't know you could get a hold of gold flakes, but you can. It says police are searching for a man who swiped $1.6 million worth of gold flakes and then made a very, very slow escape. The heist happened on September 29th in the middle of the day in Midtown Manhattan. Surveillance video shows a man slowly approaching a momentarily unattended armored truck. You can't not attend the armored truck. What good is it if it's armored and you get the back open and there's nobody standing there?
That just makes no sense.
Who's the guy driving that?
Yeah, that sounds almost like that attack in France where the guy just hopped in that big indestructible vehicle and started rampaging through the street.
Yeah, that guy's going to be in trouble. Both of them will be in trouble. But the guy that didn't pay attention to what was going on with the truck there. They usually have two people, like one to watch the truck or something and one to go inside. Anyway, it wasn't attended. And so I don't think this is a plan because you can see the video online. The guy's just walking. He looks like, there's a bunch of stuff sitting there. So he goes and he takes it out of the back of the truck. But it was heavy, though. That's the thing. And I don't even think they said that the guy knew it was in the bucket. It was just a big bucket, but he knew it was valuable. And it weighed 86 pounds. So the guy's trying to lug it out of the truck, which he got out. But they say the tremendous weight of the bucket proved problematic for executing a speedy getaway. Video indicated it took the man over an hour to lug the bucket half a mile through the streets of Manhattan, and he had to stop to catch his breath. They've got him on all the security cameras lugging an 86-pound bucket of golden flakes.
Hey, he was just going for a workout.
Yeah,
He was going to return it.
Gold flakes. That sounds like a cereal.
Gold flakes, that must be so many gold flakes to add up to 86 pounds.
Yeah, that would be. It's interesting. Where would that come from, or why would they have it in a bucket? But anyway, they did.
Of all things to leave unmanned and unprotected in the street.
And the only thing they could have done that would have been worse would be to put like a big dollar sign on it, on the bucket.
Make it more obvious what's being stolen.
Take it out of here. So anyway, this guy, he got away. Slow and steady wins the race, they say, because they hadn't caught him yet. They're still searching for him. He's described as a Hispanic male who is about 5 feet 6 inches tall, 150 pounds, and between 50 and 60 years old. The gold flakes are still missing. And what do you do with them? You sell them? Like, how do you sell them?
Black market again. Probably not too many other ways to do that.
Yeah, anyway, interesting. I mean, I don't know if the guy was a criminal before this or not, but he saw an opportunity and he took it. And so they got to man those armored vehicles a little better.
Yeah, that's too tempting for most people to pass up, probably, to see whatever it is sitting back there and knowing how valuable it is.
Well, you know, the one thing they didn't consider is maybe the guy's a leprechaun. It's a pot of gold.
It's his anyway.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to get that pot of gold back. And he did.
He stole it from me.
He stole my gold. 86 pounds. If the guy only weighs 150 pounds, he was carrying, you know, more than half of his body weight in gold.
Yeah, that's a bold move. Took a lot of gumption and a lot of perseverance to get away with that.
Yeah. So really bizarre story. And it's funny how they haven't caught the guy yet. Or the gold. But
he's on all the security cameras, but they have no idea what happened.
They have multiple angles. Like, you can watch it. You can watch him pull it off the truck. And it wasn't like he was quick with it. You know, it was like he was trying to get this thing off. And then you can watch him walking down the street, and then it cuts to the next shot of him further down the street dragging this bucket of gold.
Where were those two truck drivers?
Yeah,
or one?
If it took him, like, what did it say, like an hour to go a half mile, wouldn't the guy in the truck go, hey, where's that bucket? And then you'd look around and be like, hey, that guy is dragging a bucket. You know, wouldn't you see it? Call for backup or something?
He'd still be in sight, probably.
Where did he go? I don't know. Really strange story. Here's one other one that's interesting. You ever see a picture of a $100 million check?
No.
Well, you can see one online. It's for Floyd Mayweather, the boxer.
Should have known.
It says there's a check. He posted it to brag about how much money he has. The check is dated May 2nd, 2015. It's the date that Mayweather defeated Pacquiao in the record-breaking blockbuster fight. It made about $600 million in total. His guaranteed purse was $100 million. And you think that, man, if you get a $100 million check, it should be really big and fancy. It's just a regular check. It says Floyd Mayweather, $100 million and 0 over 100. They have all the numbers written there. They barely can fit it in the box. And it says in the memo, purse for 5-2 2015 boxing event. And then it's signed, $100 million.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah, he actually is very good at saving his money as well. He has hundreds of millions in the bank at least, if not $1 billion by now. So he's not just one of those athletes who goes out there and goes broke. He's pretty smart about saving up.
They said he, I think he worked, the boxing match was about 36 minutes.
Right.
So now, again, you know, they have to train, and there's, you know, there's a lot to it, but still, 36 minutes, $100 million. You know, like they have MMA fighting, and mm-hmm. if you have a big name, you can make some money doing that. And there's one guy that did it recently, CM Punk.
Oh.
He's a former professional wrestler. And he trained and he practiced, and then he lost in about 30 seconds, I think. And he got a pretty good payday, and I thought, man, I could lose in 30 seconds easily. I just go down on the mat and cover my head.
He just scampered across the cage and was taken down and pounded immediately.
Here's your check.
But that just kind of shows you how hard it is to enter any sport after a year and a half of training or 2 years, whatever he had. None of us could start playing basketball and then 2 years later jump right into playing in the NBA. That's the equivalent of what he was trying to do.
But he got paid for it, so.
Yes, he did. He got paid $500,000 at least.
Yeah, for 30 seconds. I could do that for 30 seconds. but I couldn't draw anybody, you know. That's the problem. You have to get a big name first.
Well, maybe if you were a complete nobody and you came out there as a dad, a father of two, just had never trained before.
Keep doing it. Records 0 and 100. He has lost 100 consecutive bouts. Just as soon as the bell is rung, you just drop and cover your head. They tap you out. Just grab onto the referee's leg in the fetal position.
Save me.
Yeah, you could probably get a little bit of a following for just being so bad at it. Like you either have to be really good or really bad to get a following. So,
well, there are actually fighters out there who have 10 times the number of losses than they do wins. And obviously, they would never gain much notoriety besides being horrible at their job. But a lot of those people get set up to fight guys who are actually supposed to be good.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I'm going to lose anyway, but at least I'm getting employed to do it.
You're ring fodder for the guy that's going up the line. The Key David program's coming up here in a bit on KPCG, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Today he talks about how the United States is spending its strength in vain, both militarily and economically. Can a Trump presidency fix that? Well, we'll leave it to you to listen to the show to get the answer. What's your guess? Yes, no. Probably not going to work out. But he's got some really good information about that.
I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. Could go either way. You've got to listen to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. I am Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon's here, and Abraham Blondo is stopping by as well. And we're glad to see you, too, because like we were saying earlier, it's cold in the studio, and another person adds more warmth.
Right. I guess you're just using me now. But
for my warmth.
Yeah.
Well, you're Canadian, so you were in like a tank top and shorts today. This is warm for you.
You know, I've been thinking about doing that on the coldest winter day, coming to school in just T-shirt and shorts, just to show the kids how much of a man I am.
Well, but I tell you, you know, off at Lambeau Field in Green Bay, gets pretty cold, and you know, people kind of pride themselves on, you know, not feeling the cold, I guess. And so you'll always have some guys with no shirts on when it's, you know, 5 degrees. But as somebody that grew up there, look, you get as cold as anybody. You know, it's not like you get to some level of like, this doesn't faze me. I mean, sure it does. Maybe not to the point, may not affect you to the point of somebody that grew up in a very warm climate, but still. You just have to wear a lot of coats. I mean, it's not like we're walking around in T-shirts when it's the middle of winter, you know.
Well, I think for me, what I realize is that if you live in a colder climate, you're used to going numb. you're used to losing sensation in your body because of the cold.
Hands and feet.
Yeah, so at that point, it doesn't hurt anymore. You can't feel the cold because you're numb, but you're so used to it, it's not a big deal.
Until you come back inside.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
It burns, and you get the pins and needles in your hands and feet. And there's nothing you can do. You just have to ride that out.
Yeah.
Do you know what we're talking about, Grant? Have you ever had that?
Yes.
You have? Okay.
I've gone on camping trips where I froze, and that's about it.
That's right. You have. Yeah, it is not a fun feeling. By the way, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at KPCGFM, and you can send us emails to comments at KPCG.FM. We get some good comments from around the world and from Canada as well, where it is particularly cold. It's hard to type when your hands are cold.
That's true. Yeah,
but they do send them. You've got an interesting story for us here, Abe, from QZ.com, Youth in Revolt. Surprise, surprise. Harvard research suggests that an entire global generation has lost faith in democracy.
Yes, yeah. This is some research done by two professors at Harvard about how millennials view democracy, how they view different forms of government compared to other generations, baby boomers, and that they compare data from about 10 years ago to how 10, 20 years ago to how millennials feel about democracy today. And it's really interesting because, as the title implies, there's this disturbing shift in how young people view democracy. And they're viewing it as a failure. They don't like it. And they're moving more in favor of autocracy and even dictatorship. There's a higher amount of young people who favor those types of governments.
What's the reasoning for? Did they give like what their thinking is, like why they would prefer dictatorship, or why they think they would?
Well, they don't know exactly the reason why there's this dramatic shift. My theory is they've done similar research on how history is taught in schools, and it's really similar actually. If you look at graphs and the data on how, just as history has declined in schools, how it's taught in universities, there has been a sharp increase in how young people dislike democracy, or they view autocracy in a more favorable light. So I think there is a direct connection between millennials, who are college age people right now, and the decline in the teaching of history.
That's a really good point, because we see that even right now with the death of Fidel Castro. I mean, if you were to listen to a lot of the media, and probably I would guess a lot of college students would agree with that, what they say, you would think that, you know, one of the world's great men has just died. But would you have rather lived in Castro's Cuba the last 50 years of the United States? And I don't think they know the history to know that you'd much rather live here than there.
Well, they are actually saying that they would rather live under Fidel Castro than Donald Trump. They're saying that right now.
If you listen to the Trumpet Hour program today here on KPCG, it's coming up in a replay, and you can catch it online as well. Andrew Miller talks about just some of the things that Castro did. He bled people to death. Like, he just drained their blood and sent it over to be used for transfusions for communists. You know, and they were political prisoners in Cuba, and he just drained their blood until they died or were close to death.
Wow.
I mean, that's the guy we're talking about here. Did that come up in anything? You know, when these different world leaders were coming out and talking about how sad they were that he died? Really? That guy? That's about as sadistic as you can get.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that when history is erased or changed, especially for people who didn't live through it, it's easy to convince them of what didn't happen. that the lies are truth, because that's what we're really seeing here with some of this data, is that people who haven't lived through different world wars, who don't have a memory of Hitler or of the Cold War, or just all the tumultuous times that happened from communism and other governments like that, they're much more favorable to those kind of governments because they haven't experienced it. I think that's a big part of it as well, is that we have young people, millennials, growing up, and they grow up in a one polar age of American power, where they haven't had to deal with a lot of challenge until really right now. And so they blame democracy for all their problems when they don't look far enough to in history and in the past to really see the genesis of a lot of issues and to see how well we are off compared to other people.
You know, and what it, I think it really comes down to, even further than just say, I mean, it is the education issue like you mentioned, but if it goes back even a little further, it's the family and the breakdown of the family, because even the infamous Saul Alinsky, who rules for radicals guy.
Right.
I mean, I think his big beef in life was that his parents split up and he had this suburban life, but he was unhappy. And so he thought he should revolt against the system. But the problem was there was a family breakdown. So if you have a family breakdown and people are unhappy in those situations, then they go off to college and they're indoctrinated. Yeah, I mean, they blame all their problems on democracy or whatever the supposed structure is, because it hasn't worked for them. But the problem is, or the real problem is that, yeah, it hasn't worked for them because people haven't applied the laws that would keep those units intact. And then they think something like Castro is going to solve their problems, where he'll actually drain your blood. But, you know, never mind that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's that's a great point, and it does show that our view of law is very personal. And what I mean by that is that how we view the effectiveness of any law, whether it's the Constitution, speed laws governing how we drive our car, or even just how we govern our life, they're all really based on personal experience. And if you grew up in a really negative environment, it's not always the case, but if you do grow up in a broken family or in a situation where there is some trauma as a young person, you might not like rules because they didn't help you that much as a young person. So a lot of people take a lawless attitude against the Constitution, against government in general, democracy, because of some intensely personal experiences. And that's another side of this too, is that we are seeing a rise in just a lawless attitude where people want to rebel against democracy, but they don't really know what they want in replacement of it. And they have some great statistics here. I'll just run through a couple of them of what they found to display this change in attitude.
And these are these two researchers from Harvard.
Yes.
And they were polling the students in Harvard or just young people, millennials in general?
It was millennials in general. Okay. It wasn't just the Harvard demographic. So they, one metric they took was, they asked the question, do you believe military takeover is not legitimate in a democracy? So in other words, are you opposed to a military takeover in democracy? Among older citizens, 43% in the United States said they are opposed to it. It's a bad thing. In millennials, only 19% said they were opposed to
it. So in our own democracy, they would not mind a military takeover.
Yeah, only 20% were opposed to it.
That's did they not understand the question?
No, I mean,
you want some soldiers to show up and like start eating your breakfast and telling you what to do today?
Well, given the context of the election this year, people think absolutely anything on earth is better than Mr. Trump being the president. And so that's probably a lot of why some of those people would answer that way now.
It's so weird because they were rebelling against freedom. And it's strange, isn't it? I mean, they might as well yell down with freedom, you know, down with personal freedom, and let's be told what to do by a dictator. Like, it doesn't even make sense. I know they're rebelling against the system, but they're trying to embrace a system that would be far more restrictive.
Yeah, that's why it doesn't really make too much sense, and that's why I think there's just a general ignorance on some of the bigger issues at play here. Like, what is military takeover?
Yeah, exactly.
And what's interesting is they did the same study in Europe, and 53% of older citizens said it was a bad thing. 36% of millennials said it was a bad thing. So in Europe, they're much more opposed to it. I think that's because it's much more recent history. In America, we've never had a military takeover. So we only learn from textbooks or immigrants who come here from other countries. So that might have a little bit to do with it. But it does, I think, show some dangerous ignorance on the part of a lot of young people. Then there's a couple other really disturbing trends. They asked another question, and they said only around a third of U.S. millennials see civil rights as absolutely essential in a democracy. compared with 41% among older Americans. So to me, both of those statistics are very bad. We're less than 50% of any age demographic think that civil rights are essential to democracy. And
it should be 100%.
Yeah, exactly.
If they're going to be here, it should be 100%.
And more than a quarter of U.S. millennials dismiss the importance of free elections to democracy. So 25% or more than 25% of U.S. millennials think free elections aren't that important, that we can find another way to get leaders in our country.
We'll have a democracy with no free elections.
Yeah, like North Korea and Russia.
Well, setting the cities on fire seems to be their alternative. That seems to be the way they think they can make Mr. Trump not take office somehow.
This is really bizarre responses. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really disturbing on how millennials view democracy so unfavorably. And, I mean, democracy has turned out a lot of failures. I mean, there are a lot of failures in America. American democracy has failed a lot of people. But it doesn't mean that turning to dictatorship, military coup is somehow going to solve those problems. And that's, I think, as Gerald Fleury talks about in Great Again, I believe, on how why a lot of intellectuals in the United States like communism, or they believe in it, and that's because they assume that's the only alternative to American democracy, because American democracy has failed. So they turn to a more radical kind of political ideology.
The great beacon of hope that is communism.
Well, exactly.
All the successes in history, the communist successes.
Yeah, that's the irony in it all, is that with man in general, is that they... we're all searching for a solution. But no matter what solution you turn to that comes from the mind of a man, it always has a history of failure.
Yeah.
Democracy does, communism does, any kind of government does. And so with these statistics, it really does show just how people don't have hope in any political system anymore, and that any other alternative is just a very bad decision.
Yeah, really interesting write-up. QZ.com, Youth in Revolt. Harvard research suggests an entire global generation has lost faith in democracy. That sounds like a generation ripe for the picking.
Yeah.
In terms of military takeover or dictatorships. Interesting. Grant, you've got another headline for us. This is pretty interesting as well. This especially is interesting in relation to what happened at Ohio State on, Monday? It's from the Washington Examiner. 99% Muslim, 43,000 Somali refugees settled in U.S. under Obama. Those numbers are pretty stacked in that way. The up in, the Twin Cities, there was that knife attack at that mall a while back, right? That was a Somali as well, wasn't it?
Right, and they have a huge Somali population up there in Minnesota. I believe Mr. Trump said that the Somali population would wreck Minnesota, but people were joking that he was wrong. It's actually going to wreck Ohio because the attack took place there on Monday.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter what state it is. The fact that these things are possible because we're just indiscriminately letting refugees come in is really indefensible from our government.
Right. And now somebody could say, well, they're not all terrorists. True. But even the guy from Ohio State, he wasn't necessarily a quote-unquote terrorist. They say he was self-radicalized by ISIS. Well, what difference does it make? You know, whether you're a terrorist yesterday has nothing to do with what you do today. If you become one today, then you are one. And so they try to make all these different they try to differentiate. But it flies in the face of thinking you can let all these people in without really paying attention to what they're doing. Because, yeah, maybe today they didn't do anything. But this guy at Ohio State, he self-radicalizes, and then he goes and attacks people.
Yeah, and the common logic is that different groups of people who are here already commit the same crimes. So why is it that we're getting upset about refugees and illegal immigrants committing crimes? Well, it's a lot harder to stop someone who was legally born here and is actually supposed to be here from committing a crime. It is a lot easier to prevent people from coming into the country from other parts of the world when we don't even know who they are. And that is something where not a single refugee or illegal immigrant should be able to commit a crime like that. We should know who they are before they come in.
You know, and there's a lot of refugees that are out there, I would think. It'd be interesting to see what the numbers are. I mean, it's not like the refugees are 99% Muslim globally. How come we're not kind of letting in, if we're going to let some in, and it's not necessarily a bad idea to help out, But what about, everyone talks about equality, right? Well, why not let in equal amounts of whatever the different groups are? But it seems like it's always pushing more towards this way, more Muslim.
Right. And there are a lot of groups that are extremely outraged by the fact that we let in 99% Muslims when in reality, I believe the percentage is down around 70 or something like that, but we're letting in 99%. There are a lot of Christians in the Middle East, people who fundamentally would agree with our way of life over here in the West, as opposed to the brutal areas of the world where they're coming from. A lot of the Muslims, not necessarily, a lot more than we would think, actually do have radical views that are anti-Western.
Yeah, and like the guy at Ohio State, they get radicalized, or they get upset. I mean, if you look at some of the quotes he made, I don't think they were private. I think he put them online. I think that he said something to the effect of he'd kill a billion infidels to avenge the suffering of one Muslim or something mm-hmm. like that. So he was pretty out there, and then, of course, he acted on it. Mm-hmm. So it is a dangerous situation when you have somebody with a different ideology that is very much opposed to the West. How do you keep it under control?
Right, and that is in their book. That's something that needs to be acknowledged. It's shocking today to see our country refuse to acknowledge who our enemies are. The fundamental Islamist ideology is opposed to everything that we live by over here, and yet we refuse to even acknowledge that. We refuse to say the words. It's just creating more danger for the people who are already here. What about the people who get knifed on a university campus when that person shouldn't even be here in the first place? Those people don't think that we should just indiscriminately let in Muslim refugees, but the people who are in power who are not affected by the refugees moving in next door, they're always the ones who are fine with them coming in.
Well, and that's a really good point. I thought about that during when that attack happened. I thought, okay, but who's responsible for letting, say, him in? I don't know his situation, if he was born in the U.S. or if he was, you know, if he was the child of immigrants. I'm not sure how that worked. But still, somewhere along the line, somebody said, this is okay. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, maybe you wouldn't know. Maybe there's no responsibility there. But at some point, isn't there some responsibility? It's easy to just say, self-radicalized, ISIS. But see, nobody's responsible then. And it seems like there should be some responsibility up the line if you have people committing these attacks. Like, who okayed it? Like, who okayed a lot of these things? Especially when, like in the guy from Ohio State, he was very publicly out there being very critical of the U.S., threatening violence. Well, we talked about yesterday. I mean, if you threaten violence on the internet, you can go to jail for that. What about this guy? Why was he just roaming around after threatening to kill billions of people? I mean, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, it's interesting just how there is a standard and how certain minorities are sheltered from certain laws. And that's a trend we've really seen for a long time in America, on how certain minority groups are sheltered from laws and from certain punishments because usually the government or people in power want to create a multicultural society. They don't want certain people to be subjugated to negative media, that kind of thing. But I had a point to support what Grant said earlier about the all the other refugees the United States isn't accepting, or that the media isn't reporting on, and that's in Mosul. So that's the city that the Iraqi army is trying to take back from ISIS right now. It had about 1.5 million people before ISIS took it over, and there were around 70,000 to 60,000 Assyrian Christians. So Christians who just lived in that part of Iraq, and no one knows what happened to them to this day. They don't know if they fled, if they escaped, if they were killed, or what exactly happened to that 60,000 to 70,000 people. And that's a good example of how the media, there's been so much media hype and discussion on Islamic refugees, and rightly so. There's been a huge crisis in Europe about that. But what about those Assyrian Christians who we don't know if they've been killed or where they are? And why didn't anyone do anything to help them when we knew that they needed help? That's just a good small example of how Christians in the Middle East and people who really do need help, when they're caught in between two Islamic armies fighting each other, they do need help. They do need a place of refuge, and no one is really opening the door for them.
Yeah. And it could be, to some extent, I don't know, maybe people are afraid of uncorking a quote-unquote holy war. But eventually, it is a battle of ideologies. So, you know, and that's been the way it is historically. That's happened many times. And they can try to keep a lid on it, but it seems like those tensions are very high, especially in the Middle East, very high.
Yeah, when it gets down to it, the Christians over there are in more immediate danger than the Muslims. If ISIS is tearing apart a country, what group of people do you think they're actually going to target and kill first? Their fellow Muslims, who very many of whom actually agree with their radical ideology, or the Christian group, none of whom actually agree with ISIS? Obviously, they're going to kill the group that they know for sure is all infidels.
Yeah, and there's always a lot of infighting within the Muslim world, but still, enemies can band together to fight another enemy that's more different than them, and so we see that happen a lot, and it's historically been the way it is. So, interesting, a lot of refugees floating around. I haven't heard a lot about it from Europe lately, other than they keep catching people that are planning attacks, and they keep talking about that. Thankfully, hasn't been one in a while, but we'll see how that goes. They're definitely pouring into different countries, Europe, the U.S., and the U.K.
Yes, and the trouble even goes beyond attacks. The same with illegal immigrants. They actually receive a lot of government benefits. I thought I heard a stat about 90% of Muslim refugees come here and immediately get on government assistance, maybe like $1,200, $1,500, $2,000 a month. That's a hefty chunk of change for someone who is debatable should even be here, because there are no vetting processes that are really sufficient right now.
Really interesting. Yep, you can read the rest of that. The Washington Examiner, 99% Muslim, 43,000 Somali refugees settled in U.S. under Obama. And that's just the Somali refugees. And, of course, that's in the news because of what's happened. But what about the others that have come in through that southern border? And, of course, these have come in, you know, as refugees. It's a little different situation. But the illegals that are pouring in as well, there's a lot to consider there.
Yeah, look at the nations where they're coming from, too. Those are failed states. And a lot of the blame has to fall on the ideology that caused that state to fail, and yet we're bringing the same ideology over here.
Yeah, really interesting. So those are some of the stories going on today. We appreciate you joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We hope you have a great rest of your Wednesday so we slide into the weekend, the slow slide. Have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.